Welcome to Cancer Conference Update, ESMO Congress 2025. Today we're focusing on prostate cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Raina McKay from the UC San Diego Moores Cancer Center in San Diego, California, for her thoughts and some of the key presentations on prostate cancer.
So as a way of background, you know, we've all been eagerly awaiting the results of the CAPItello study following a press release earlier this year that stated that the study was positive for its primary endpoint of rPFS. And this study was designed basically in the mHSPC setting for patients that had PTEN deficiency. And the threshold that was utilized to determine PTEN deficiency was greater than or equal to 90% of viable tumor cells not having PTEN expression by IHC, which is a little bit more stringent, marker than what was utilized in the ipatasertib, which set the bar at 50%. And of those greater than 6,000 patients screened, 25% of patients were actually positive, and patients were randomized 1-to-1 to receive capivasertib plus abi versus placebo plus abi with a primary endpoint of investigator-assessed rPFS. And so, yes, the study was positive. It met its primary endpoint of a statistically significant improvement in rPFS. But I think many were questioning, you know, is this a clinically meaningful difference, even though it's statistically different? So the hazard ratio for rPFS was 0.81, and there was a 7.5 month difference between the two arms with regards to rPFS. And then the overall survival hazard ratio, though the data are still immature, and I think there just hasn't been enough events yet, only about 25% of events at the present time, is 0.9. So I think in the mHSPC setting, the bar is just a lot higher with regards to clinical benefit and tolerance for toxicity. You know, with the capivasertib, we did see an increased rate of diarrhea, hyperglycemia, rash, AST, ALT elevation. That's classic of these sorts of agents. So yes, I think this data really highlighted the poor prognosis of patients who are PTEN deficient. We need to really try to identify better strategies for these individuals. There was a statistically significant improvement in rPFS, but the question is this going to be clinically meaningful, and is it going to translate to an improvement in overall survival? And there were increased toxicity, as would be expected with AKT inhibition.
So just a couple of questions to follow that up. I was really curious what they were going to see in terms of hyperglycemia, because they were given it with abiraterone with prednisone. Any sense about how much of a problem the glucose was? And do you think that's enough prednisone to be part of the problem?
I do think it's a problem for these patients because they've got multiple risk factors because they're on ADT, they're on abiraterone, they're on prednisone. We have to monitor for metabolic syndrome. It's an older population at risk of cardiovascular disease. So I don't think that the hyperglycemia is inconsequential. I think yes, maybe the abi and the pred impacted a little bit, but we're clearly seeing differences with capivasertib compared to control that I think is driven by the capivasertib.
I was fascinated by the control arm having such a short PFS of 2 years. Also, he made the comment, Dr. Fazazi, that they saw a lot of people who progressed imaging-wise, but not with PSA. And also that it's so common, 25% of these patients out of the 6,000, that's not, in lung cancer, some of these mutations they target are a lot less frequent. So I just thought that, kind of maybe this is a new sort of subset of prostate cancer that people are going to start, not so much just about whether or not to give an AKT inhibitor, but maybe look at differently. Like if you see somebody with PTEN, would you be more likely to consider chemo? Because do we know that chemo works in these patients, incidentally?
Very interesting question. I think actually at ASCO over the summer and ESMO last year, we saw evolving data from STAMPEDE. And there was actually a subset analysis that was conducted from STAMPEDE that looked at the P10 sensitivity signature that's derived from the Decipher score, and that did seem to be potentially predictive of response to chemotherapy in the MHSPC setting. And you know, there was kind of the non-overlapping Venn diagram with the IHC. The take-home message is that patients that have P10 deficient prostate cancer, this is an aggressive patient population. This is exactly the type of population that needs to be escalated. I think it's the data from St. Peter provocative around utilization of chemotherapy in this context. I think it also highlights the need for systematic imaging as opposed to just PSA for monitoring these patients. So I think there's a lot of really important things that we can take home from the Capitello study, just even for routine practice, like tomorrow, like how do we track and manage these patients? You know, because many patients may not even undergo imaging in the MHSPC setting, just tracking PSA.
Anyhow, the hormone sensitive metastatic space obviously has gotten really wild and crazy with PARP.
Yes.
And chemo is already out there, and now lutetium, and this here with the P10. So anyhow, to me also, I kind of feel like it's justification to get this assay, even if you're not going to use the AKT inhibitor, just for prognostic reasons. Any thoughts?
Absolutely. I mean, I do think that it's important. I think that having the IHC is certainly something to consider and start to integrate into, you know, various, you know, panels like you do your PD-1, PD-L1, you know.
Right. And this idea that they might relapse imaging-wise, have you seen that in your practice? Do you see patients like this that, you know, progress imaging-wise or clinically, but still the PSA is not going up?
Yeah, we do. It's not a common phenomenon, but we do see it, which is, I think, why it's important to continue to periodically image individuals in the MHSPC setting.
One other final thing that he talked about, you mentioned the 90% bar they use, but then they also looked, I think, 95, 99, 100, and it looked like, sounded like they did better, had a better impact as it increased. Any thoughts about that?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, there was kind of an exploratory analysis using different thresholds of cutoff for the IHC sensitivity, and the hazard ratio for RPFS improved as you had a more stringent cutoff, but also the patient population kind of got smaller and smaller and smaller with the more stringent cutoff. And so, you know, I think if you look at the, you know, 100% cutoff, I think it was less than 10%, you know, close to 7 to 8% of the population that actually would have ever met that criteria. So if you think about this trial where they screened over 6,000 patients to get to the 25%, you know, that's going to be a lot of individuals that are out there. But so I think we're moving towards a model in the MHSPC setting where we're trying to better personalize therapy. We saw data from Amplitude, data from PSMA Addition, now Capitello. And I think there's this movement within the field to try to figure out, like, how can we better escalate based off of the biology of the underlying disease driving the therapeutics, which I think is the right strategy to employ for how we treat MHSPC. This was a study I think we've all been eagerly awaiting the results for. Again, we also saw in a press release that this study was positive. This study was actually presented in a presidential session at the Congress. And it was basically testing lutetium plus ADT and RP versus ADT-RP alone for patients with MHSPC that was PSMA PET positive on gallium PET imaging. It enrolled patients that had an ECOG of 0 to 2. Patients were randomized 1 to 1 between the treatment arms. It was an open label study. The primary endpoint was RPFS, and crossover was permitted. Strat factors included, a volume of disease and other variables, and whether the primary tumor got treated or not, given that's something that can potentially impact outcomes. It was a positive trial that met its primary endpoint of improved RPFS with this population. Hazard ratio 0.72, which is a respectable, you know, hazard ratio. I think when we look at the number of events, it's, you know, just, 24% of patients in the treatment arm had events, 30% in the control arm. So I think, you know, it definitely met its primary endpoint. you know, I think it leaves a lot of questions. There was also lots of data that were shared around, you know, the PSA response data and objective response data, and that patients really by 1 year, you know, over 70% of patients are receiving an undetectable PSA. And these patients all received six doses, or intended to receive six doses of treatment given 6 weeks apart. And so this is like a 9-month course of therapy. The overall survival was also trending in the right direction, hazard ratio 0.84. So I think, you know, this is certainly promising, but, you know, it does certainly come at a cost with increased toxicity, you know, anemia, neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, the cytopenias that we are cognizant of. Dry mouth is really also important to point out, 46.5%. And I think we do a poor job in CTCAE grading capturing dry mouth. And, you know, grade 3 dry mouth is like, you know, parenteral nutrition for dry mouth. But grade 2 dry mouth can be pretty problematic for many individuals. So I think we need to better understand these data. So I think the data were really quite promising, but lots of questions are got around the subset of individuals. I think in the data presented, there was a high proportion of patients with visceral metastases. We need to better understand that. So, but definitely promising.
Promising or ready for prime time, ready for approval?
I don't know if it's ready for approval exactly today. I think we need additional follow-up data on the adverse event profile and the, you know, overall survival, just to really better understand what the role is going to be. You know, one of the big questions is, you know, if upwards of 70% of patients are getting to an undetectable PSA by 1 year, and the bulk of those individuals have gotten to an undetectable PSA at 6 months, because in some of the other data sets, we're only picking up an additional 10% from the 6 month to the 12 month mark. What is dose 3, 4, and 5 of treatment doing? You know, are you just giving, you know, if somebody already has an undetectable PSA or there's very minimal PSMA avid disease, you know, the response rate with hormone therapy and dual therapy is high, you know, what are those later doses doing? But, you know, the team should be commended. You know, this study started out as a cooperative group trial through the Alliance. It transitioned to an AFT study, which is the Alliance Foundation, and then ultimately actually became an industry-sponsored trial. And there's been a team of you know, investigators, Scott, Michael Morris, and others that have been heavily involved in this, in the design of this trial, and actually seeing it to its realization. And this is one of the first studies that's actually comparing to the control arm of ADT-ARPI in this kind of population. I think there's going to be really important data that we're going to glean from it. One of the biggest questions that we were talking earlier is, what's the concordance rate between PSMA PET and conventional imaging, and how do you quantify that? And this whole high volume, low volume, all based off of bone scan and CT, we're hopefully going to see some data emerge from PSMA addition around that categorization. The ENZARAD study is a phase 3, also investigator-initiated trial that's looking at enzalutamide with ADT for patients receiving definitive radiation therapy with, you know, high-risk localized disease. And, you know, kudos to the team, I think, for planning this trial with ENZUP leadership. The primary endpoint was MFS based off of CT bone scan per ICE-CAPS, and patients received 2 years worth of therapy with ENZA and an LHRH analog. It was an open label study. I will say that the control arm did include a non-steroidal antiandrogen such as bicalutamide, as opposed to just an LHRH analog alone, and strat factors were based off of, you know, things that we know impact prognosis, Gleason score, T-stage, nodal status, PSA, and so forth. Study, you know, sought to enroll just over 800 patients. The study was negative for its primary endpoint of improvement of MFS, hazard ratio 0.88, but this was not statistically significant. And, you know, I think one of the biggest take-home points is, you know, really risk stratifying individuals in the upfront setting is going to be critically important, because they're, you know, patients with localized prostate cancer have a very, very long runway. And many individuals may never develop metastatic disease or have disease that ever impacts their overall survival. And there's probably a lot of overtreatment in this context. Like, I think we need to think about who are the people that really need treatment intensification. And I think Enzirad really pointed that out. Like, when you carve, you know, that, you know, Paul presented subset analysis based off of nodal status and based off of prior radiation and trying to overlay the Stampede high risk criteria, which are more rigorous than just like NCCN high risk. And in those higher risk populations, there did seem to be a benefit, but in the just, you know, run of the mill, you know, high risk, you know, a little bit of Gleason 8, and that's the only thing you got, like, we may be overdoing it with escalated therapy. So I think, you know, it just kind of calls into question our need for, like, appropriate intensification strategy in the right patient population.
Do you think that you and your colleagues were surprised by this? I remember a CME program not long ago, some faculty person said, every time we intensify endocrine therapy, we get better results as we go earlier and earlier, and this looks like it may be an exception to the rule. What do you think is going on here?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I was expecting this study to be positive given the degree of, you know, data that's out there around the role of these agents in the you know, high risk population. But I think as we get into localized disease, I think you know, there's a lot of heterogeneity within that, even within that high risk group. And you know, you could be high risk with just one core of Gleason 8, or you could be high risk with T3B disease, Gleason 10, and a PSA greater than 20. And those are two vastly different scenarios. And so I think more granularity in that context is going to be important. I think, you know, integration of Decipher, Artera, other sort of prognostic tools that could be overlaid within that high-risk group to really try to define who are the people that need intensification the most.
Yeah, actually, we started getting involved with prostate cancer quite a long time ago because it was the biggest trial in the history of oncology, not prostate cancer, looking at high-dose bicalutamide, the adjuvant study there. And yes. If I remember correctly there, the problem was that it wasn't high enough risk. They didn't have enough events.
Yeah, that's right. You know, so I think that's...
So I don't... Maybe that's what's going on here.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I think there's going to be a lot learned and a lot to tease out. Like, the other piece here is that they actually compared to bicalutamide, you know, similar to what was done in Enzimet. Right. And I, you know, standard of care, but many people do not get concurrent bicalutamide for 2 years in this setting. And so I think that could have also impacted the results.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. McKay, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Cancer Conference Update.